welcome to the Irish Left Archive podcast. In this episode, we speak to activist and academic Camilla Fitzsimons. Camilla's academic work focuses in particular on education and social movements, and she's an associate professor in Maynooth University School of Education. Her publications include two books, Community Education and Neoliberalism, Philosophies, Practices and Policies in Ireland, and Repealed, Ireland's Unfinished Fight for Reproductive Rights. We discussed Camilla's early political experience, her involvement in forming the Spectacle of Defiance and Hope in response to service cuts and austerity, which organised marches and workshops with a central focus on political education, her work on abortion rights and the repeal referendum and her book Repealed, feminism and differentiating left feminism from the right and liberalism, and Palestine solidarity activism in light of Israel's genocidal assault on Gaza, and Camilla's work with Academics for Palestine, which seeks to build the campaign for an academic boycott of Israel and help create awareness in the higher education sector. You'll find Camilla's website at camillafitzsimons.com, and there's a link included in the notes with this episode. You'll also find links to some of the materials mentioned during the discussion. You'll find the Left Archive at leftarchive.ie. As always, we welcome any feedback on the podcast or on the project in general. You can contact us via the website or email us at contact@leftarchive.ie. Thanks to Camilla for taking the time to talk to us, and thank you for listening. Thanks, Camilla, for joining us. We'll start at the beginning, I suppose. Can you tell us a bit about how you first became politically active and what that entailed?
Yeah, sure. I mean, thanks for having me, first of all. Great to be here. Yeah, I've been thinking about this a little bit, how I became politically active. And I suppose in many ways, it was kind of almost a slow burn that kicked in when I was very young, because I would have grown up in a family where, well, first of all, there was nine of us. It was a very busy house, typical of an Irish Catholic family back then, with my mother, who was absolutely worn out her whole life looking after children and giving birth to children. But, you know, within that household, even though we were okay financially, there would have been a very strong sense of kind of social justice and a very strong sense of equality kind of instilled into us, particularly from my dad, around, you know, mostly the charity model, I guess you're talking about back then. But there was always that sense, well, we have a house, other people don't, you know. There would have been a halting site quite close to where I grew up as a child. And, you know, we would have always been encouraged to not to, you know, to see travellers as, you know, also members of the community. And, you know, that would have been quite deep. And then I guess when I left school, I work in academia now in education, but I didn't do well in school, partly because so many children in a household. I was one of the older. You get pulled out of school to look after younger children, all that sort of stuff. But I ended up in nursing. And really, I think when I was working as a nurse was the first time that I really saw class kind of, you know, front and center. You know, class is everywhere, you know, in a hospital environment, both in terms of how patients are treated by doctors and other nurses, but also in the illnesses that people get. It's very hard to get away from class. And this, you know, had kind of such an impact on me that the first thing I did when I graduated was I signed up to do a sociology for nursing course, was kind of the first thing. And I realized, oh yeah, I'm not imagining this. You know, if you are poor, you do actually get sick and die younger, and you do actually get treated much worse by the healthcare system. So I suppose that was really where I started to become that kind of, you know, eye-opening moment of thinking, wow, this world is really unequal, and what do we do about it? And I would have been in my sort of probably about 26, 27 when I joined the Socialist Workers Party, as it was back then, and mostly because I had a sister-in-law, now wasn't sister-in-law at the time, and kind of dragged me along, said, come along to this crew, I think you'll like what they're saying. And sure enough, you know, I think one of the first things I went to was a very early Marxism, which was in Parnell Square back then. So you're talking about, I think, as I say, 96, 97. I remember Breed Smith being particularly influential person when I heard her speaking. It was kind of that moment where you go, oh my God, other people think the same way, other people talk the same way. And I joined Socialist Workers Party at that time and stayed, pretty heavily involved for about 3 years. I would have, I think it was only quite recently I said to Breed Smith, I don't think I ever actually left the Socialist Workers Party formally, but I did. I did step away from being involved in kind of revolutionary party politics in around 2000, which was when my first child was born. So part of it was a very different stage in my life. But another part of it was, I think I was coming to the stage where I just didn't feel that it was the right space for me at that time in my kind of political life at that stage. So I kind of stepped back from political activism for quite a few years there. And I think it's something that I've kind of written about and thought about later is that there really isn't often enough appreciation given for, women who are activists who do have to step out for a few years. I mean, all of my kind of activist life, I've heard women and men also, but mostly women apologizing for having to, not being available because they don't have childcare or having other priorities. So I, that idea of the ideal activist is usually male without any ties, and that kind of deficit that women can kind of carry into activism. And I think that was much stronger back then. In 2000, I think things have changed now. Organizations like the Abortion Rights Campaign have been part of that change. Also anarchist groups, RAG have been part of that change. But certainly in 2000, I even remember conversations about people saying, well, if you were truly committed to the party, you wouldn't have children. I mean, those sorts of conversations did happen, women having those conversations. But that is, I think we thankfully we've come a bit of a distance from that. But it was certainly part of my story of dropping out of activism was becoming a parent.
And did you move on to other forms of activism as, as time moved on, or did you were you attracted back to the party model?
Never back to the party model. I've never been a member of a political party since then. I mean, definitely part of my issue, as I touched on, was the kind of the centrism model didn't really work for me. I remember feeling under pressure to do things that I didn't particularly feel motivated to do or wasn't necessarily even agreed with. So it was a model that didn't suit me. But I do find, I've always been active, and I'll talk about some of those pieces. I will always defend many of the people that I met back then that I am still would know quite well, because really, I'd much prefer to spend my time giving out about the parties on the right than the parties on the left, because there are so many people. Like I mentioned, Breed Smith, but other people I've worked closely with, Sinead Kennedy, Melissa Halpin. I know I'm deliberately kind of naming women, but people who have really worked so hard for the left, to the people with the ladders in their back of their car often as well, the people out late at night hanging up the posters, the people who have been involved in so many campaigns that I've kind of dipped into, but have been really very involved in doing a lot of the logistics that don't get done otherwise are often the people who are in those parties. So I do have a lot of respect for the commitment that they show. In terms of, the other part of your question was kind of getting involved in other activism. I mean, absolutely, I kind of came out of that kind of bubble of having young children. So I would have had three young children close together, so kind of three under five. So even then, I definitely would have had times where I'd be pushing the buggies on the demos and that sort of thing, but I wouldn't have been organizing at that stage. I would have always, though, kept a keen interest. I would have always made sure to shout something at anti-abortion protesters outside the GPO. I have memories of having very young children and shouting, women have a right to choose at the top of my voice, and my young kids going, Mom, what are you dang, what's going on here?
You won't be thanked for that by
Yeah,
the
so I mean, and then of course, when they're teenagers, do we have to go on another
kids.
menstruation? You know,
I've had
but
this experience.
yeah, so it's always been there, but I suppose the first time I kind of formally re-engaged in any campaign or any piece of work was something that I think is kind of absent from the history of the left in Ireland. And I think it was the reason that I originally kind of thought about getting in touch with you guys was a piece of work I was involved in called The Spectacle of Defiance and Hope, which I mean, the main people who were involved in that would be John Bissett, who many people know as a kind of a core community activist, Rita Fagan, myself. A woman called Fidelma Banas, who's always been very involved in pro-Palestinian work, and Noreen Byrne, who's a community activist based in Clondalkin. So we would have been the kind of core organizing committee, for want of a better expression. And then there was many other people were in and out. Brian Fleming, an artist, was very involved for a while. And really, what we did was we came together to try and launch a campaign and organize a sustained campaign against the absolute brutal cuts to the community and voluntary sector in Ireland, which started really in 2008. So this is the kind of time frame I'm talking about. The first response was, you know, I think it was eight community development projects who were particularly political got an email to say that their funding was being stopped and their funding was immediately withdrawn. And over the next few years, then there was a very deliberate dismantling of the community and voluntary sector where their assets were sequestered, their voluntary boards of management were shut down, and they were really depoliticized. So what the Spectacle of Defiance and Hope did was we framed that through a very, very clear political lens. We very clearly framed the kind of context of the cuts to the community sector alongside what was happening with the bank bailout. And you know, I mean, I was having a look back there on one of the kind of short videos that we made for one of our street demonstrations. So we had two very large street demonstrations, which had thousands of people on them. Very
I
much a
remember.
spectacle. They were very theatrical. And, you know, one of the intros to kind of get people on board was, you know, the Irish government will give 100 million of your money to bondholders. And we directly linked that to the austerity budgets and to the cuts. So one of the things we had was the Grim Reaper, I remember one year was kind of leading the charge and everybody carrying headstones with the names of projects that had been shut down. I don't know if either of you were on those demonstrations, remember them.
Yeah, I remember that one.
I think what people often don't know about those demonstrations was the amount of work that happened behind the scenes in terms of what we would have described as kind of politicizing work and politicizing education. So when I kind of left nursing, the career that I went into was in community education and working with women's groups initially, but later on broader groups than that. And that was really having that idea that, you know, education is never neutral. Education always either teaches us how to conform to capitalism or teaches us how to try and disrupt capitalism. That kind of, you know, real, you know, dichotomy that is presented, or that real kind of binary division around education. So a big part of the spectacle's work was educational. So I remember, for example, going around to community groups, explaining to people about the cuts. You know, all of the costumes that people wore were designed within community groups. We had the second year was around what we called a book of grievances, was the kind of focus of the campaign, and that came from deliberately borrowed from the French Revolution, where people created books of grievances from all over France and you know, made these public. So we did that. You know, we went around mostly around Dublin, but outside of Dublin also, and we worked with community groups to gather their book of grievances. And you're talking about at a time when you know, we were having a series of austerity budgets and people were really, really in dire straits. So we were like, well, write your grievances. And these were all brought out on the demonstration, presented to, you know, the Dáil, but of course nobody's they're not listening. but presented anyway, and also the sort of Songs of Grievance and Hope project again. It wasn't just musicians in a room writing songs. It was community groups. So I would have been involved in one group where a musician came in, did the kind of workshopped with a group of community leaders, for want of a better expression, that I was working with, which was made up of a third of people who were living in direct provision, a third of people who were volunteering in the community, and a third kind of paid community workers. And between that group, they harvested lyrics, put them to music, and the kind of Songs of Grievance and Hope then came from that kind of politicizing work that we did with a good few groups. You're talking about probably 50, 60 groups were, engaged in that process all around the East Coast in particular. It's a big
That's
piece of
great.
work that people don't necessarily
That's
know.
huge and enormously time consuming, I imagine, as well. Like,
Well, I mean, there were certainly, for the 2 years that I was heavily involved, I felt like my full-time job was for the spectacle. Don't
right.
tell my employers. But it was a huge commitment, a huge piece of work.
And do you think, looking back, I mean, obviously that must have generated some sort of solidarity amongst the people involved. In terms of broader outreach towards the broader community and beyond that, how do you think it played, or how do you think it worked?
Yeah, well, it's the million-dollar question, really, isn't it? And it's almost in a way how it didn't work to some extent. And I'll give you another example of something that we did that kind of stemmed from the spectacle to explain what I mean there. So one of the key kind of partners at one stage was a group that were back then called Debt and Development Ireland. They're now called Financial Justice Ireland. But Debt and Development Ireland were doing a lot of work at the time around trying to educate people around vulture funds. They were doing a lot of tax justice work. So one of the kind of things that they did was they used to go outside banks and set up a fake crime scene. And they'd do, crime scene here,
Bell,
and get kind of photo shoots. Or when somebody from Apple was visiting Trinity College, they were there throwing apples at, I can't remember who the speaker was, but we got
that's
quite
awesome.
involved. I got quite involved with Financial Justice Ireland. I ended up joining their board and staying on their board for about 3 years. But one of the pieces that the Spectacle and Financial Justice Ireland worked on together were these very deliberate workshops, which we called the Irish Debt Crisis, What Happened. So we put a huge amount of work into designing a workshop which explained, what's a promissory note, what's a bondholder, what did the banks do, where, why are the austerity budgets happening? And really, we had, like, I remember we had a poster which was a jargon buster and really just demystified the work. And I would have been very involved in designing the kind of educational framework for that, and would have delivered the workshop to trade unionists, to community groups. But why I'm saying it didn't work was the model, or the hope for the model, was that we would design it, we would run it, and then other people would run, and it would kind of multiply out. That never really happened. I mean, we did find that usually for any of the workshops, it was kind of, there had to be somebody that was very involved or very central to it. It didn't kind of develop the wings that we had hoped it would develop. So even something like the spectacle, and maybe this is where, again, left-wing parties are important and revolutionary parties are important, because so much work can go into something, but so much of it can be carried by key individuals. And then if they withdraw or pull out for whatever reason, things can just stop very quickly.
Do you think it fed into, obviously, the later austerity campaigns focused on water? Do you think it had even an educational impact? Because clearly it had some impact, because but I think you're right, like, it doesn't sound, it didn't have the traction that later campaigns had, but I just wonder, is that because the later campaigns then blossomed and were larger? I mean, I don't know what's the answer even in.
I mean, some of the answer comes back to the fact that the community sector was decimated. It didn't stop that. So, however great the spectacle was, and however kind of nostalgic I can be about it, or people that were involved, they went ahead and cut. So even a lot of the people who would have historically managed it, had to move into other pieces of work, other areas of work. I do think then that the water charges movement, kind of, it's not that it took over, but certainly a lot of the key people who were involved became very active in the water movements then. But I don't know if you remember on one of the water charges marches, these giant big billboards of, I think we had billboards of the ministers that were responsible it for kind of trying to introduce the water charges. That was done by the spectacle. Like, we were still active. We made those banners. I was on stage along with some of my kind of comrades from the spectacle singing some of the songs of grievance at, I think, at that largest anti-water charge movement demonstration. We were on stage singing, sure, up beside Glenn Hansard to go, ooh, famous, but so for a while I think the spectacle kind of held its own identity within the water movement, but then I think it did kind of just fade out. And many people, and obviously the water movement was an enormous victory, and that was the right space for people to be, was to be involved in, a campaign like that. But again, always trying to join the dots, keep that left-wing analysis, keep that focus on, capitalism, and, that anything that any of these governments concede, first of all, we always have to fight for it, and second of all, it'll always be as little as they can give. Packaged up as something much more than it is. Just still surprised me that they haven't come back for more with the water charges. I thought they'd be back sooner than now to try and sneak them in, but
And they can take stuff
not yet.
back. If they can give it, they can take it back.
Exactly,
Can
exactly.
I ask you, do you think, and this is slightly as an aside, do you think that sort of political consciousness building, which I think the spectacle was about, do you think at this remove it has filtered through to those sort of groups that are currently in action today? Or do you think that depoliticization effect has continued or got worse or maybe ameliorated a bit? I don't know.
No, I mean, it's a really good question. I think it's always been kind of marginal within education, even within community education. So, when people say to me as an academic, what are your interests? I always say education in community spaces and social movements. So that's kind of how I word what I do. So you're talking about trade unions, community groups, campaigns, wherever. And I think that consciousness raising education piece isn't widely understood and known about. I think the kind of chalk and talk still dominates even within left-wing spaces. Go back to those political parties, on the left, the dominant. I do see some changes towards a more kind of participatory, dialogic consciousness raising approach. But the dominant model is still kind of, I'm the expert, I have all the information, and I'm going to pour it into you, and you're going to agree with me. So I think we have to continue. I have to continue. Whoever of us sees, agrees with me, has to continue to, really say, look, education is actually one of the biggest ways that they maintain capitalism. It's not the great leveler. It's not the thing that, it's packaged. Even school is packaged as this thing that creates equality. School does the exact opposite. School is deliberately designed to maintain the capitalist class structure. The notion of meritocracy is completely mythical. And I do think that's still a marginal understanding or a marginal perspective. So I think there's still a lot of work to be done, especially perhaps within the trade union movement. Just because it's the biggest. That's why I'm not picking on the trade union movement, but it is the space that has the most members and the most capacity to potentially, be part of the change we want to see in the world.
Broad left organization.
Yeah.
It is. It's the ballast.
And even go back to the spectacle. The reason we were able to do a lot of that work was that Unite gave us 10 grand. So they were able to give us kind of unrestricted funding. They just said, there you go, there's 10,000. And it really enabled a lot of that work to happen. That was a huge boost for that work at the time.
Was there a point where you said, right, the spectacle is over? You actually said, right, that's it? Or did it was it a case of it frittering out?
I think it, yeah, I think it we kind of we called a day because it had begun to kind of peter out so much. So it just became the right thing to do. We hadn't managed to stop the cuts, as we say, but there wasn't really ever a moment that I recall where we said, right, pat ourselves on the back or critique our work or whatever it is. It was more kind of a peter out. But I suppose for me, what was happening at that time was, the repeal movement was starting to really take off. So I guess, I mean, I can talk about that a little bit if you want, and my
Yeah, of
kind of
course.
entry in there was real. And again, it's educational, So I think around 2015, I kind of answered a tender from the Abortion Rights Campaign to design community education material, as they put it, to design workshops which really weren't about kind of preaching to the converted, but were workshops. It was based on a model that Alliance for Choice in Northern Ireland had used, where you went into regular community groups, regular women's groups, and said, okay, let's talk about abortion, which simply did not happen in Ireland. I mean, I remember the first time I ever heard people talk about abortion was probably Melissa Halpham in People Before Profit back in the 1990s. And I was so shocked. I think people have forgotten just how deeply ingrained that kind of secrecy and stigma was. So the point of the kind of educational work that I did in 2015 was to try and encourage those conversations all over Ireland in ordinary groups, because it just wasn't happening in regular women's groups at all. And from there, I became, I was kind of peripherally involved in ARC for kind of 2018, 2015, 16, but I would have kind of stewarded on the marches, helped organize for some of the marches, would have gone along to their workshops around creating, banners and posters, would have written a couple of articles for some of their kind of publications. And I really think that ARC did a lot of really, really good kind of work back then in terms of just that stigma busting. I mean, even that decision to have the word abortion in the name was really important and was radical. It was, pretty radical thing to do at the time. And I know there was discussion about it at the time. But that was kind of how I got involved in the repeal movement. And then in 2017, I joined my local group, which was establishing. So I live in Dublin 7, so I'd have joined the I think it was called the Dublin West Repeal. This was before the referendum would have been announced, and this was established by Ruth Coppinger, the former TD, and Marion Dwyer, who was a GP in the area. And they got together and called a kind of a local meeting. And my daughter would have come along to that. She's 20, whatever, she's be 24 this year, but she was a teenager back then. And kind of just got involved at a local level. And then when the referendum was announced, became a canvas organizer in my local area. Kind of it was amazing the way you got to know neighbors who were living 4 doors down from you that you'd never known before. But now you were hanging out every night, knocking on doors. And I think that's where I really started to see how my two worlds could almost, come together a little bit better in terms of what I would consider my contribution to the left, was to use some of my research skills as an academic and try and actually, document some of what's happening. So I had a moment where I was on a canvas one night. I'd been out every night with my daughter, with my neighbors, meeting new people. Pretty much every house we knocked on was absolutely yes. There was very few no's. And I just kind of went, is anybody actually documenting this? Is anybody actually paying attention here in terms of recording history, essentially? So that's what I decided to do. And I kind of had to get ethical approval from my employers in Maynooth, which delayed me a little bit. But from that, launched a kind of a survey, for want of a better expression. It's probably not the right word. It was a kind of open-ended questionnaire. And over the next 2 years, engaged with over 400 people who were actively campaigning for repeal, and just got a sense of, their reasons why, whether or not they were politically involved. And then when I went back to people 2 years later, were they still active? What were they active on? And really just try to capture the reasons why people were canvassing, what they thought about the Together for Yes campaign, what was their own experiences. So many people who were canvassing, but not everybody, did had their own experience of either having to travel for an abortion or knew somebody who had traveled for an abortion. And really just trying to get that down on paper so that we could remember it and use it into the future. I think, some people were critical of the Together for Yes campaign before the vote, and I think my research kind of captured that. People felt it was too conservative a campaign, that it had moved away from the kind of more justice-oriented message. But I do really try and differentiate between bad faith criticism and good faith criticism. And, I really wanted to capture that good faith criticism, which is how we learn from the repeal movement, carry it into the next thing, rather than saying, like I think there was an article in the Irish Times that I quote in the book Repeal that I wrote, where, leading journalists saying this thing will never work, it's a leaderless organization. It actually did have leaders, they happened to be women, but just trying to I was trying to differentiate my own or people's critique of Together for Yes from that critique. Listen to that, if that makes
I
sense.
think that was David Davenport or Stephen Collins, wasn't it? I think he said
Yes, it
that.
was definitely Stephen Collins was one person that, yeah, I remember that.
Amazing critique on their part. Just so wrong. Anyway, did you when you were doing the survey, sorry, you when did you send it out exactly, and when did you get it back
So it was
exactly?
out, it was live for I think it was 3 weeks before the referendum, and I closed it before the vote. Because I wanted to capture in real time. I didn't want people to be filling it in through rose-tinted glasses of a victory or, the other way around. So I really wanted to capture what was happening before we knew how the
Good
vote would
result.
go. And then a second survey was 2 years later, but you had to have canvassed to be eligible to fill in the second one.
And you mentioned something interesting, I think, which I think there was a lot of concern or apprehension or hesitation almost beforehand, a real sense because of all the defeats prior to that, this would be potentially, I mean, and obviously that changed during the campaign and even I think before it, but the scale of it was amazing. Just the scale of the vote.
And I do. I mean, one of the kind of arguments that I make is that one of the reasons, because I do believe that the Together for Yes campaign was quite conservative. I do think that it forgot, migrant voices were completely really excluded. Working class voices very much excluded, and it very much conjured up the image of the kind of middle class woman, making a decision in the privacy of her GP's office. Totally removed from, the housing crisis, the quality of a job that somebody has, whether or not they're in a, violent relationship. These are many of the reasons that people have abortions. It's not this, pondering what I will do. It's because of the socioeconomic circumstances of people's lives that make this a necessity. And that was dropped by the campaign, and I do think you're right. I think a big part of that was really heavy defeats in the past, that some of the people that were still involved had experienced those defeats, and they were heavy defeats. There's no doubt about it. I mean, it took a long time for feminism in Ireland to kind of claw back from two defeats in the 80s, being the insertion of the Eighth Amendment and then the failed divorce referendum. It took the kind of the Irish feminist movement, and John Walters writing about feminazis didn't exactly help. And he was a credible journalist back then. I think that's what people forget. So that I get it why people felt unsure. But I do think that hopefully what we can learn from that campaign is next time around to trust that the electorate are capable of the political analysis, and that maybe that can be a piece of consciousness raising work itself at a very broad scale, can be to to focus on the main, one of the main reasons that people in Ireland choose to have an abortion at the moment is probably linked to the fact that they might be in a hotel room with three other children already and no sign of, a home.
Nowhere
These
to
are
live.
the factors.
Was there anything that came out of the research that you did that surprised you, or that really struck you as maybe unexpected from your perspective, or?
I think one of the good things that came out for me was that a third of the people that I spoke to were still politically active 2 years later. So some people had joined political parties on the left, mostly on the left. I don't think anybody mentioned. So some people had joined People Before Profit. Some people had joined the Green Party, which I wouldn't consider a left-wing party now, but certainly were, I think, masquerading as one at that time. And people became involved in other campaigns, even in my own group, in my own area. So that local group that I described earlier, that group is now very involved in gender-based violence work and has organized a number of local initiatives. So, the core group that met around then in Dublin 7, Dublin 15 are still pretty active now. And in fairness to ROSA, the feminist organization that's connected with the Socialist Party, they've been really a central part in, helping local groups like that to maintain the work. So my local group does have some ROSA members, but not all of us. I'm not a member of the Socialist Party or ROSA, but they have done a lot of work in keeping as much as possible some of those structures that were built up around repeal, keeping those groups active. And I know that's been replicated in Galway, that's been replicated in Limerick, where I've spoken to people who are still involved in left-wing feminist-based groups because they got involved around the time of repeal. And part of that is because the legislation we have around abortion is just so bad.
Yeah, it's not fulfilled
People
at
are still
all.
fighting on that front.
Yeah. I mean, with exclusion zones and so forth, it's I mean, I think it's a really good case in the book about like how so much is unrealized even at this point in 2024.
Well, the Abortion Rights Campaign circulated an email which
Right.
looked at coverage around Ireland. And just to kind of give you an example, so there's three providers in Mayo. Think of the geographical size of Mayo. It's massive.
These are
So there
GPs,
is
or is
now providers in every
oh yeah, sorry,
county,
providers,
but sorry, GP provide for people who are, what that means is people who are publicly saying we provide abortions, GPs. But if you have a situation where 50% of people can't get signed up to a GP at the moment in Ireland, there's huge problems. But again, I mean, that's where I kind of see my role on the left as well. So I would have done a piece of research around the safe access zones without any funding. I just decided to do it myself because I'm a public sector worker, essentially. And did a big piece of research, had a formal complaint made to my employers by Senator Ronan, what's his name? I've forgotten his name, Ronan
Mullen, Ronan Mullen.
Mullen, which my university defended me 100%. But there was an
Good.
attempt to kind of discredit me and discredit my credentials. And I around that particular piece of research, I would have got a lot of heat on Twitter and stuff, people telling me that I didn't really have a PhD and I'm, fake researcher and all this sort of stuff. I think it was over 40 complaints were made against me to my university, but my university completely backed me, were very supportive, I have to say. And that piece of research that I did then, I just published that open source and it then appeared in that independent review that was carried out quite recently. So, for me, that just kind of showed me as well the importance of academics on the left actually,
Engaging
doing
with it.
this work and using our institutions as our kind of rigor that we need for the research.
That's interesting. So in other words, not merely is it that it hasn't been fulfilled, but there's also pushback.
Oh yeah, for sure. But I mean that even that kind of experience that I had, I'm also very involved in trade union movement. My trade union, IFUT, would have done a lot of work around them, around precarity in academia, which is a massive, massive issue. Many
Huge
people
issue.
paid below minimum wage.
Yeah.
So imagine if that research had been done by a precariously employed researcher, they wouldn't have had that sort of protection that I had as a kind of tenured
Tenured,
academic,
yeah.
permanent member of staff. So, you know, it's just another piece of the story, isn't it, that people are tied into structures and systems where they're only allowed work on kind of funded research, which won't necessarily be left-wing, or they're so precariously employed that they just can't take the risk of you know.
And a chilling effect then becomes more than just a chilling effect. You potentially lose your job or
absolutely
what employment you've got, because you're probably on a, yeah.
Pay by the hour.
Well, it's what you say in the book. I mean, it's like that everything is linked into everything else. You know, reproductive justice isn't just a slogan. It's linked into other parts, like you said, fertility. It's linked into, you know, I mean, it just goes on and on.
Yeah, I mean, the three kind of principles of the reproductive justice framework is that kind of right to have children, right not to have children, and the right to parent children as you choose. And, you know, if you keep those three things central, you cannot be somebody that aspires for a reproductive justice framework and somebody that supports capitalism. You just can't. It's just a massive contradiction. And, you know, the people, the African-American movement, Sister Song, who kind of conceived of that reproductive justice framework, or certainly the best, you know, known for that, would be very clear about their anti-capitalist perspective.
Yeah.
That's very clear.
Yeah.
But I think as well, you know, if you look back to Irish history, so, you know, Gretty Horgan, for example, was somebody who was probably one of the earliest pro abortion activists in Ireland. And I remember Gretty telling me that, you know, one of the first flyers she ever remembers putting together talked about the right to contraception, the right to abortion, but it also talked about the right to decent housing and a decent income to raise your children. So in many respects, the left have always carried that wider understanding and that reproductive justice framework. But so much of that stuff is being colonized. So much of our language is being colonized now, intersectional feminism, reproductive justice by, you know, I think, I mentioned it to you earlier, I'm working on a current project at the moment around feminism. And one of the things I talk about in that book is a Fianna Fáil TD describing himself as an intersectional feminist. I think it's one of the funniest things I've ever heard in my life.
I want to ask who.
Which no, I'm not going to say.
That's okay.
That was a moment. But that's the extent to which these ideas have been colonized and taken.
And appropriated.
Appropriated,
and then redeployed back as well. I think we were saying beforehand, like, it's really interesting that you sort of took the pieces of it apart by talking to people and then getting a sense of what was an actual hugely specific piece of activism in Ireland in a very specific time frame, and talking to activists about being active and what that means. Do you think there's an argument to be made that this should be applied to as many campaigns as possible, that we have a little bit more insight into how these things work? Perhaps picking apart again the Water Charges campaign, that's another campaign which I think has had some interesting after effects. I think mostly very positive, but some not so positive.
Some the opposite, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to know. I think the repeal movement was an explosion of the oppression of women in Ireland for so long. You know, my own story, I do often bring my own kind of experience of being in that household with multiple children. You know, anybody who's my age in my early 50s have seen our mothers really have a horrendous time. And I think in many ways the repeal movement was really just a build-up of so much.
Yeah.
I mean, the other thing that kind of comes close to it and I think is not over is the Make Our Maternity Hospital Ours campaign. You know, again, I think it is really, you know, women in this country have been treated so horrendously and horrifically for so long, you know, in the 20th century, that I think there's almost a fear, I hope, within the political establishment to kind of, you know, let sleeping dogs lie almost at the moment. I know, for example, I'm probably not answering your question here, but I think part of the repeal movement is that it became so active so quickly, and it has proven since then that it can be responsive again. So when we, you know, there was a huge amount of amendments proposed after the referendum, all of which were rejected, except for an agreement that the legislation would be reviewed 3 years later. That was the only thing that was agreed. But when the review came around, there was an initial attempt by Stephen Donnelly, who was the Minister for Health at the time, to kind of quietly announce that he was going to do a desk review. And boy, did he have to do a U-turn very quickly, because the extent, it even surprised me, the extent to which the repeal movement woke up immediately and said, "Oh no, you don't. This is what you promised us." It was a huge kind of hashtag campaign. I remember being at meetings that ARC organized, and this is, you're talking about COVID was still part of the picture, but I remember online meetings and you'd have 60 and 70 people, which is a lot of people to get to something like that, because this promise, there was this attempt to break this promise around the independent review. And he had to U-turn straight away. And I think that really taught them. And I think that's why, again, with the water charges, it's tapping into something that's really impacting on people's lives and that real deep inequality. And I do like to think that, again, if I can't even remember if it was before or after we started recording, talking about if they ever did try and introduce water charges, I think, again, that kind of movement, we might be surprised as to how quickly
It swell
it would
up.
reform and emerge again as a force to say, this is the red line, guys. This isn't happening.
In a way, the question then becomes, was the repeal campaign a broader campaign than the left with left elements, or a left campaign that kind of grew, well, for the sake of it, grew legs in a sense and became more, it just, I mean, I think what you're saying, there's enormous persuasive. There was actually an upwelling of anger and upset and enough's enough and I ain't gonna take this no more. After so many defeats as well, I think that was another. Like, there was marriage equality, of course. That was
Yeah, and that was an
humongously
important part
important.
of the repeal story. I do think that was an important aspect. I think, again, you know, part of the maybe the, you know, the learning from Together for Yes would be what Together for Yes did tend to do was turn to the right rather than turn to the left. In terms of, it was a broad-based campaign, but I am in favor of broad-based campaigns. Once you hold, for me, once that political analysis is held, I'm perfectly happy to work with the National Women's Council of Ireland, for example, once the boundaries of the campaign are clear and aren't compromised. So if you look at the assault on, you know, trans rights in Ireland at the moment, National Women's Council are really leading the way there in terms of, you know, how feminist organizations should behave. I'm very happy to work with the National Women's Council on that. Other aspects of their work that I wouldn't agree on and, you know, wouldn't endorse certain things. But I personally, you know, I mean, my own kind of left-wing activism is to be, have that very clear left-wing anti-capitalist analysis at the core of what I do, but then be prepared to work with other organizations who share that, and that core, it doesn't get, you know, bent or doesn't become that performative piece that I talked about earlier, that it's the heart and soul of the campaign.
So where does it go from here, like, in a sense? Because obviously on your own personal side of things, you've been doing this research into working with Irish feminists, and researching their lives and their activism. Well, perhaps just take the current research that you're doing in terms of Irish feminism and that history.
Yeah, I mean, and I think a lot of it does stem from the repeal movement. So I think one of the problems of that turn to the right, one of the problems of the victory of repeal, is how that can be appropriated and claimed by forces that would never have brought it in of their own volition. I mean, we have, you know, female Fine Gael TDs who will champion their involvement in repeal, but will be the same women who voted against increasing search and rescue missions in the Mediterranean for migrants. And so, you know, there are, I guess what I'm trying to do at the moment is I'm trying to really kind of filter out a version of feminism that is socialist, anti-capitalist, on the left, and dispel some of this idea that, you know, the United Sisterhood of feminists, that being a woman is something that makes you oppressed, that repeal movement was a victory for all women, because it wasn't, because some of the, you know, you have Frances Fitzgerald, who was involved in the National Women's Council, was admonished for the European Court of Human Rights, I think it was. I hope I'm not mixing up where, but certainly she was the person that led an argument that the Irish government tried to make, which said that a person's human rights could be violated if that was the majority opinion of the nation. So she was basically trying to argue, well, in 83, we voted for this, so it stands. And she had to apologize. She had to say, okay. So after repeal, you know, people on the right were also saying, oh, Irish feminism, victory for Irish feminism. And I guess I just wanted to really cut through that. So the project I'm working on at the moment is interviewing key, mostly women, not exclusively women, but key people on the left who would also kind of be supportive of or ascribe to kind of the idea of being a feminist, because not all of them would call themselves a feminist. There's been times when I have been reluctant to call myself a feminist. But it's really just trying to talk to people across politics, trade unionism, people working in NGOs, people working in campaigns like the Make Our Maternity Hospital Ours, people working with migrant organizations, you know, just a wide range of people, really, and just getting a sense of what people are doing at the moment, how alive feminism is in Ireland at the moment, because I do think it's alive. Like the first chapter of the book opens with a typical weekend in Ireland where there was four street protests happening, one in Belfast, one in Dublin, one in Cork, all not connected with each other, but all around violation of women's rights.
Yeah.
So it's very much alive. I think the one that was happening in Dublin was 1,000 people were marching to mark the anniversary of Savita Halappanavar's death.
Yeah.
The one in Belfast was about the closure of a hostel for women, where there had been a sit-in by staff, and there was trade unionists were very involved in that. So I'm really just trying to identify left-wing feminists and, you know, differentiate ourselves from liberal feminists or right-wing feminists, and you know, really kind of deconstruct some of what's happening at the moment in the name of feminism. Because people on the left, like I would argue, and other feminists I draw from, people like Sarah Ahmed, Sarah Farris, international writers, who would really argue that feminism can do an awful lot of damage, an awful lot of harm. I don't know if you've heard of Rafia Zakira, who talks about fighting feminist wars. So the idea that imperialism is disguised as, if she talks about Afghanistan in particular, so this notion that we're going in to save Afghan women from these terrible Afghan men, and how they need the white
savior.
Western saviors. And you know, she would argue that if you're a feminist on the left, and if you want to support women in Afghanistan, we'll give money to grassroots feminist organizations in Afghanistan and let them determine what is the best course of action. And the notion that a woman in Afghanistan would have more in common with a right-wing white woman in the West than with an Afghan man is just absolutely farcical. So it's just really trying to reframe people's thinking, but it's also trying to look at some of the damage in terms of this. The woman I mentioned a minute ago, Sarah Farris, has coined this phrase of femo-nationalism. So this is where the far right are deliberately using women. So Giorgio Meloni is the best example. deliberately using women to bring in very anti-woman, anti-everything agendas. So Maloney, if you look at Maloney's campaign, she talked a lot about being a mother.
That's right,
she
yeah.
talked a lot about her identity as a woman.
Yeah.
And then you have a situation that after she's elected, she's congratulated by Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
So it's really about trying to dispel a lot of that is what I'm trying to do. And show that that version of feminism in Ireland is actually very active at the moment. And, you know, validate people who are doing that and, you know, distance ourselves from some of the more conservative elements that dresses itself up as feminism, many of which is happening in the Dáil.
And do you think it's getting worse? So, yeah, you're saying it's getting worse, basically.
I think if we can look, you know, you write a book and you think everybody will read it, and the reality is only a handful of people read it, you know. But I guess what I'm trying to do is get the idea out there that if you're involved in something in your own community and your own area, you're not on your own. There are other campaigns happening. The Make Our Maternity Hospital Ours campaign can connect with the, you know, anti-gender-based violence campaign, can connect with the housing action campaigns, can connect with the work of CATU, that all of these things are feminist issues. I mean, you know, Rosa are running some really good events at the moment about how Gaza is a feminist issue. You know, these are the kind of connections that we have to make, which really kind of, you know, distances ourselves from, you know, that kind of siloed identity politics, for want of a better expression. And again, keeps that spine, which is the left-wing analysis, and keeps that really strong.
Some element of class politics at a minimum, kind of.
Well, I mean, that intersections of class and race in particular, but also citizenship,
big time,
you know, ableism, you know, heteronormative ideas, you know, these things have to, the list gets longer, but it always comes back to capitalism. I really do think it comes back to, you know, a very small, you know, an absolute obscene model of capitalism that we have at the moment, of, you know, a very small number of mostly men, obscenely rich, and how, you know, economists who know much more about this than I ever do have actually been able to kind of track the flow of wealth away from ordinary people and into the pockets of a handful of men. We've never had a model of capitalism like that before. It's really obscene, and it needs to be just called out in as many spaces as possible all of the time.
Yeah. It is worse. That aspect is definitely worse.
But it's worse for women as well. I mean, you know, any of the, like, particularly worse for women, we've, you know, organizations, Oxfam in particular, who look at, you know, what's called the social reproductive labor, you know, that, that unpaid work that women do, trillions of dollars worth of unpaid work that women do. And I think, again, part of my current project on feminism is trying to explain to people that that is built into capitalism. Capitalism only works. It's not, you know, we have the workers, we have the surplus profit, and then there's the bit out that women do for no pay. That at that kind of period of the Industrial Revolution, I don't want to go too deep into history, but that period in the 1800s where, you know, the Industrial Revolution and the kind of in particular changes in agriculture in terms of technology, that there was a kind of a point in history where we've had patriarchy for much longer than that, but there was a point in history where capitalism and patriarchy became absolutely dependent on each other. And it does, capitalism doesn't work unless women do the bulk of the unpaid domestic and care labor. And now on top of that, you have a really precarious global migrant workforce of women, you know, this kind of chain of care, as it's sometimes called, where, you know, someone, you know, who's, you know, white and middle class like me gets to go to work because I bring in a, you know, a poorer woman to look after my kids. She in turn gets a poorer woman to look after her kids, and the cycle continues rather than any, you know, really substantial leveling out of care. No a responsibility taken by the state in terms of care, just you know, absolute denial that it is the responsibility of the, it, that there's any collective responsibility for care.
You're also involved in Gaza and activism around Gaza at the moment.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, any, I think any of us that are on the left have, you know, been very aware for as long as I've been politically active. I guess I've been aware of, you know, what's happening in the occupation of Palestine, the role of Israel there. But I suppose at the moment I'm particularly involved with an organization called Academics for Palestine. So this is an organization that formed in 2014. I wasn't involved in its establishment, but I would have got involved really as soon as I became a full-time academic. I would have signed up to their pledge. So what Academics for Palestine do is they ask Irish academics to respect the BDS movement, the call from civil society organization in Palestine, that we refuse to work with Israeli universities, that we refuse to contribute financially to any, you know, be involved in kind of major research projects or any sorts of collaborations around work that, you know, maintains that status quo. It doesn't preclude you from working with individual academics, particularly who are pro-Palestinian, for example, but it is an important prong of the BDS movement. An academic boycott is a very powerful thing that can really kind of cripple, you know, certainly the academic community in Israel. But, you know, obviously we're living in a very challenging time at the moment, and since October the 7th, things have really escalated in terms of my work there. So about 6 months earlier, in I think it was May of last year, I was at a conference in England, and it was a reproductive justice conference, and I was there to talk about the Irish Repeal movement and talk about some of the research. And I don't know if you've ever been to a conference, but you have a panel of speakers. So I was, you know, panelist number three, two speakers before me, and the speakers before me. It became evident very quickly that this was an Israeli university that had snuck into the kind of conference, partly because it wasn't recognized that there was a partnership between an American and an Israeli university. And they presented a piece of research, whatever they wanted to call it, before me about reproductive justice. And I was sitting beside these people. Had I been in the audience, I would have left. And I regret not actually doing more than I did, because what they did was they talked about reproductive injustices globally, and they never mentioned Palestine. It was quite phenomenal. They talked about India, they talked about injustices in the United States. And, you know, I'm sitting there absolutely shocked. So when it came to my turn to speak, I did say, well, I'm really quite shocked by that, and I'm really surprised. And I said something like solidarity with Palestinian people. And as I recall, I think people kind of clapped. And actually, I remember now what I did. I invited people in the audience to just talk to the person beside them for a few minutes, because everybody was a bit shocked, I think, by what had happened. And when I left that conference, I went, I need to know how to behave better in that situation. So I got involved in the Committee of Academics for Palestine, the National Committee, which would be about 8 or 10 of us working across Irish organization, Irish universities. And what we do then as a committee is we just organize meetings and discussions around campuses. And at the moment, a big piece of work that we're trying to do is put pressure on our own institutions to make a much clearer, take a much clearer stance on the genocide that's happening in Gaza. So Academics for Palestine have done things like, you know, drawn from, you know, scholars around genocide, Holocaust scholars who are saying, no, this is a genocide. This isn't a word that is just being thrown around. People who have actually commented on previous Israeli incursions and said, well, that's not genocide at the moment, are saying, no, this is genocide. These are obviously, we know that because of the decision of the courts recently. So we're trying to put pressure on our own institutions to, in many ways, behave the way they behaved when, and the way they rightly behaved when Russia invaded Ukraine. They were very quick to condemn very quick to fly Ukrainian flags. Very,
Yeah.
I very much supported that. But the response has been very different this time around. So we've been involved in, in Maynooth, we now have an Academics for Palestine Maynooth branch. We've crafted a statement, which is a kind of a community response. We have, hundreds of signatures, which really does. I jotted it down here because we have made five demands of our institution.
Right, go on,
First
let's
is
hear.
calling for an immediate ceasefire, the second being urgent aid, the third being UN protection, the fourth being to reject ethnic cleansing, and the fifth being to support the dismantling of the colonial and apartheid system. But this is the response we want from our university, not what we're getting at the moment, which is the two sides, really problematic, really actually quite disturbing responses, which, the first casualty of genocide like this is truth. I'm an academic. We have to champion the truth. Also working with organization like Scholars at Risk, who are trying to get scholars out of Palestine and Israel, and highlighting that every university in Gaza have been bombed since last October. There have been extremely high casualties of academics and students, that academia
That's a
is
great point.
a target being targeted by Israel at the moment, deliberately targeted. And, it's really important that Irish academics refuse to engage. So it's just, it's an important piece of work for me to be involved in. We've organized some vigils on campus. We've organized two teach-ins where we just invite students again. This is back to the consciousness raising education. Working with Palestinian colleagues in the college as well, I think the first one was really successful. There was about 70 students showed up. Second one, about 30 students showed up, and these are just students who are around the campus. We just hang up posters. We call out, work with the students' union, and really just the message is no such thing as a stupid question. Come along, we'll help you kind of understand what's happening, and just really get dialogue going on our campuses around the country as to what's happening in Gaza and Palestine more broadly at the moment.
Is there any institution in the country, if you, or on the island, or even in these islands, which you think is handling this in the way that it should be handled? I mean, is there anyone
Galway
that you can point?
University.
Galway, right, Grant.
So I would really encourage people to have a look at the statement that was issued by Galway University, which came about as a result of several conversations with Palestinian staff and students, as I understand it, support from the Irish Palestinian Solidarity Campaign, and a really, really good response from Galway University. I don't know if you put notes up under
Yeah,
the
we do. Yeah.
podcast episodes, but it would
Yeah.
certainly be worth linking that.
Oh,
I think it's really put it up to the other
yeah. Yeah, no,
universities
we'll include that. Yeah.
as to the, and they're calling for an immediate ceasefire very clearly. And it's been a really good to see an Irish university take a lead in this way. I think it's really put it up to the other universities.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So they can't hide behind a thing of, so there's now, yeah. So they can't hide behind, oh, well, nobody else
Galway
was
have
doing
shown
it.
that it can be
Yeah.
done.
Yeah.
The other thing is that the TUI, the trade union,
Yeah.
TUI, have signed up to the academic boycott as a union.
Yeah.
So I think that's really significant. That hasn't happened for my own union, IFUT. So at the
Right.
moment, myself and some colleagues in Academics for Palestine, we're working on trying to get a, unions are, I love them and I hate them. Lots of people, I'm sure, can relate. They can feel very old-fashioned, very bureaucratic. It's kind of a two-step process we're involved in at the moment to try and get a rule change within IFUT to enable us to introduce a motion calling for the trade union to support the academic boycott. So it's that kind of slow, laborious. Am I filling out the right form? Am I getting it in on the right date? Really important work to try and get IFUT, which would be, as I think it possibly the biggest trade union for academics, I'm not sure, to get them to support the academic boycott and encourage all members to support it. Hopefully, it gets through. It's not a given.
Really, it's
There can be differences of opinion over this. I mean, one of the biggest things we did was a letter to the Irish Times, which had a huge number of signatories. I think there's over 1,000 signatories on it now. But there was a counter letter from academics now, which was much less, but there was a counter letter nonetheless, which objected to the idea of an academic boycott. I know that other people on the left have said similar things when I've spoken to them. I feel I can be more effective not in a political party than in a political party, probably because I'm an academic. It allows me to just, well, it allows me, I think, to, I can work with, I might work with the Socialist Party on one thing. I might work with People Before Profit on something else. I might be working with an NGO on something else. So I very much see myself as a left-wing activist and very dedicated and work very closely with political parties. But I think there's space on the left for people like me. There's space to do that, to try and be almost a bit of a, sometimes I do find myself being a little bit of a connection. I mean, I could get a text from somebody in People Before Profit saying, will you get in touch with somebody in the Socialist Party and ask them if they want to do this, because they know that I kind of know all of the particularly around kind of women's rights. I tend to know the players in the different spaces.
And just on that, like, I think everybody should read the book, because at the end you actually have a really useful glossary of the organizations as they
Better to the
were
left.
after the referendum. And it was really interesting. I was looking at the numbers involved, and I was actually quite impressed by how high they were long at, well, not long after, relatively after. But it's that kind of thing, as you're saying, like, that network, that connective tissue between different elements of what the left is and where it is. And I mean, just in this discussion this evening, you've mentioned the unions, you've mentioned the political parties, you've mentioned NGOs, you've mentioned campaigning groups, and like, these are kind of broad fronts.
Yeah, for sure. I've just the other thing just around to so the book that you're talking about. So for people don't have to go out and buy the book. So Digital Repository Ireland have actually harvested some of the actual raw data,
All
and
right.
that's publicly available in the National Archives. And what they've accompanied it with kind of the first chapter of the book, if people do want to have a read. But it does. So that kind of survey that I've mentioned, people can actually see 400 answers or whatever, and you can go in and you can look and see the actual wording of what people were saying. And so people might be interested in having a look at that. I mean, I
Great.
was delighted when they were approached me and said, we want to kind of archive this so that it is publicly available for anybody who wants to have a look at it. The other thing that they archived also was, I mentioned earlier on, educational work that I did in 2015, so before repeal, about workshops for women's groups. And they've also archived some of that
Eight.
kind of raw data, again, anonymous people who were activists in ARC at the time, who are talking about, what they see as the role of consciousness at raising education and changing attitudes nationally. So it's all available for anybody to dig into and have a look at.
Very
That's
interesting to
great,
compare and contrast the two from earlier and then later, and then see how things have changed. And again, consciousness raising, you mentioned it yourself, like, just how people felt better. When does your new book come out? When will that be, the interviews be published?
Yeah, so hopefully either the end of next year, yeah, sorry, end of this year, early next year, it's Rethinking Feminism in Ireland. So yeah, I'll keep people posted.
Please do. I
But
think that.
some really, really good, dedicated activists. One of the interviews, I mean, I can name people because they've all agreed to be named, but
Name a few,
really, really good interview with Lynn Ruan, talking about the incredible work that she does in the Seanad, and how much time she puts into linking with community groups, because she came from that community development, community education background as an activist as well, and so just incredible work that's happening by left wing activists around Ireland, and you know, hopefully it'll be of use to any of us who are activists, and you know, really trying to also even deconstruct that word activism, you know, and drawing from some scholars who, you know, really challenge some of, you know, I don't know if you've heard this kind of elite capture idea and the pass the mic trend within activism, where, you know, just shove a mic under somebody who's got the lived experience and then you've done your job. You know, I'm not saying that people with lived experience shouldn't be front and center of campaigns, but it has to be with the social analysis that has to be part of it as well. And it's about really holding that analysis, that anti-capitalist analysis throughout.
I think that makes an awful lot of sense. Because otherwise there isn't a groundwork, would that be the right word? In a sense, there's not a foundation for
I mean, there's several reasons. I mean,
critique.
one of the reasons is that it's not fair on people to ask them to continually tell their own story. It's an aspect of the repeal movement where people were, you know, how many times does somebody have to tell their story? Surely we're at the stage now where we can compose stories, where we can, rather than, you know, sending people out again and again and again. So there's that side of it. But there is also the side that, you know, some people who have experience of things are not necessarily the people who are gonna, they could have a right-wing analysis, for example. They could have a very, you know, I know there's that kind of rise of the right at the moment and the power that people are having around, you know, particularly vulnerable groups in terms of you've no house, well, it's the migrants' fault. You know, sometimes our role is just that slower educational piece, that consciousness raising piece, rather than always thinking that the only way you can be an activist is to be putting the people at the center of the experience, passing them the mic, as it said, and asking them to speak. You know, sometimes it's not, it's, you know, again, we have the analysis, you know.
Completely agree.
I mean, I think, you know, your podcast is also a really important part of left-wing
I
activism.
don't know about that.
And
Oh, we'll take it. I'm leaving that in. That's good.
I know, you're very
but
good.
it's
Thanks very much
true.
for
I mean, no, it
that.
is true. I mean, it is definitely part of, you know, the archiving process. It's part of, you know, recording the history. The book I'm working on at the moment has it's kind of got a thematic focus. So one of the chapters is on unions. And I have three children, 18, 20, and 23, all working in retail. None of them even knew what a union was. None of them are in a union. I asked some of their friends. None of them, they're not being taught this stuff in school. So we need things like your podcast, you know, to keep the discussion going, to inform
To get.
people, because it's not, this is back to the education is never neutral. It's not going to happen unless people like us do it.
Yeah, it's that is that yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, it's staggering when you think people don't know about unions.
Really looking at, I mean, myself as a trade unionist and my role, and you know, trade unionists, if you look at someone like Jane McAlvey, who's written a lot about trade unions, and would really say that we are in a defensive mode where all of our focus is on already unionized workplaces. I mean, as far as I know, today in Ireland, Deliveroo drivers stopped work for a few hours. And I'm going to try and speak to some of them if I can. But I know that the last time they did that, and somebody asked them, had they had any backing from the trade union movement, and they didn't really understand the question. So, you know, we have to ask,
That's a
you know,
fair
as
one.
committed trade unionists, I think we need to get out of our defensive space. It's important that we stay where we are unionized, but we have to find a way to work to modernize, to recognize that people move between jobs, to recognize that people move across borders, and to start to connect with the most precarious of workers who are keeping capitalism turning by cleaning the toilets. It's like, you know, what people say, if you get on the bus
Absolutely.
at 7 o'clock at the weekend in the morning, it's all migrants going to work. They do the crappiest jobs for the least money. And where, you know, trade union movement needs to be better at doing more there. I'm not sure what that more looks like, but we need to work that out and do more.
Thanks a million. I mean, that's been
no problem.
An absolute brilliant.
Yeah, thanks so much for your time.
Not at all.